Yes, please. What's your question there for Dr. Zacharias or Abdul Murray?
Why did God put the tree in the garden to begin with? He ultimately knew what decision Adam and Eve would make. So why even put the tree there to begin with? Because it makes it just seem like we're just a big social experiment.
You know, the thing about skeptics sometimes when they ask us these questions, and I'm not saying it's you because I don't know the background from which you're coming, is oftentimes I wonder whether they realize we ask these same questions. You know, we struggle with these issues. It's not like we think these are invalid questions. They are very valid questions. But what does the question assume? The question assumes something very critical, that the answer should be coherent. Because a coherent worldview is what you're really looking for. You cannot be comfortable with incoherence. And the question that was asked earlier, the whole issue of how does one talk to a Stephen Hawking. The fascinating thing about the talk that Stephen Hawking gave in 1990 at the Lady Mitchell Auditorium, which was packed, on the question of is man determined or is he free, he went through about 25 minutes of all kinds of scientific arguments and so on, and his culminating statement got an audible response of, oh my, is this the best answer we can get? And what he said at the end is, yes, we are determined. He was under the stranglehold of determinism right from the beginning in a naturalistic framework. He said, yes, we are determined, but since we do not know what is determined, we may as well not be. That was his concluding statement. Yes, we are determined, but since we don't know what is determined, we may as well not be. What he's really saying is, since we don't know the answer to my the explanation for my conclusion, let us live as if it is not a legitimate conclusion. That's really what he was saying. So I say, when you're looking for a coherent worldview, look at it this way. What options would there have been for the great creator in the beginning of this? No world at all. Versus this world. Okay. Number two, creating a world where there would be no such thing as good or evil, an amoral world. Number three, choosing a world where we would only choose good, where we'd be predetermined to choose good, there would be the total constraint. So we've got three options. Nothing versus what we now have, no such thing as good or evil, or creating a constraint where we would only choose good and where we would never make the evil choice. Or number four, creating this kind of world where there would be the possibility of good and evil, and we are given the option of the privilege of freedom and making the choice. Out of these four options, this option is the only universe and the only world in which love is possible. In the previous three, love is not possible at all. Love would not have been possible between the divine and human interaction. So I say this, sometimes these are mega questions and macro questions, and other times they are filtered down into micro questions and the fine-tuning of an individual life. I found the answer to this, first of all, from the negative. You take a naturalistic framework, you live with an incoherent world. I couldn't live with that. So how do I find coherence? In putting together the diversity in my own heart, which was put together by God. And that knowledge of a personal relationship with God would change not only what I did, but what I wanted to do in my personal life gave me hope, meaning, and a relationship. Let me give you just two quick illustrations because I think this is critical. I've had the opportunity of speaking at one of the most famous prisons in the world, Angola Prison in Louisiana. Abdu was with me, some of my colleagues were with me. 6,000 plus prisoners there, 85% of whom are in life without parole. It was the bloodiest prison in America. Blood on the ceilings, blood on the carpets, blood on the walls. When a prisoner was checked in there, he was given a dagger or a knife with which to protect himself. And this warden comes in, this director comes in and says, I'm going to change this place. You allow me to do it my way. He put a Bible in every cell. He had chapel every day. He has a seminary that he's built in there. Within a matter of a year or two, it became the safest prison in America. Today, instead of a gang of thugs, they've got gangs of pastors going through that prison out there, and they're the prisoners themselves. We had lunch with them. And I said to the guy sitting opposite us, why don't you and get yours? He said, hey man, I'm going nowhere. You may as well go and get yours and then I'll join you. The guy who led in worship, a young man, I said to him, can I ask you a question? Because led worship so beautifully. I said, can I ask you a question? Are you here for a life without parole? He said, yes, sir. I said, how do you feel? He said, Mrs. Zacharias, if you'd known why I am here, you would never ask me that question. He said, but let me tell you something. Out there, I thought I was free, and the horrific things that I did destroyed people's lives and destroyed my own. Now, inside prison bars, having found Christ, I have never been freer in my life. This is the most free I have ever been. Pray for my family. They're outside and think they are free when they are really not. And he put his arm around me and prayed for me. And there were tears running down my face. We had lunch made by the prisoners. The warden sits there, eats the lunch that the prisoners have made. Boy, you call that faith? You better believe it. And he does it. Why? They have found meaning by an individual life being conquered. When you know Christ, when you have that relationship and your will is transformed to his will, you find out why you were made in the first place. And the crowd is just multiplied opportunity for individual conquest that God desires in every life out here tonight. I'll leave that with you.
Hi, I'm Naomi Zacharias, the director of Wellspring International. I'd like to take a minute and talk about Wellspring, which is the humanitarian arm of Ravi Zacharias International Ministries. The vision of Wellspring is to identify and financially equip existing organizations aiding women and children at risk. Additionally, we work to provide individual scholarships to support education, healthcare, and basic living needs. We would love to hear from you, and we welcome your support. 100% of every gift designated for Wellspring goes directly to a project on the ground. Please call us at 770-449-6766 or email us at wellspring@rzim.org. Thank you for the opportunity to talk with you about Wellspring International. And now let's get back to today's teaching with Ravi Zacharias.
Next question, please.
Hi there. I was raised by a mother who was a feminist and is a questioning Christian at the moment. And she finds that there's some contradictions somewhere in the Bible that states that male have to be dominant over women and women have to be submissive. So just from a Christian perspective, does God favor a gender specifically?
And you know why? What I think, your mother has a fair question there. I don't think it's just in a vacuum or in any sense of just trying to be cavalier about it. Not just that. You think of the very nation that he chose through whom to reveal him and reveal himself. He could have chosen Rome. He could have chosen Greece. He could have chosen Babylon. In fact, William T. Ewers, talking about it in a piece of poetry, said, how odd of God to choose the Jews. But then he went on to say, how odder still are those who reject whom God chose. God, I think, oftentimes in life, for the human life, chooses the weakest through whom to make his strength manifest. If you were to ask me what really makes this world, you know, let me dispel one idea here. You often hear a statement, men are more cerebral, women are more emotional. Nothing is farther from the truth. But I'll tell you what I have found. Both are equal cerebrally, but women are more consistent in willing to let the thought be connected to the emotion. Men like to hide from the emotional ramifications of the thought. So if I talk to my mother, she'd immediately connect the emotion with what she was thinking. With my father, he could draw circles around it because he'd run from the feeling. I've talked to husband and wife. We were on a vacation once, and they had both lost a son. And the woman was talking to my wife and said, it has put such a strain on our marriage because my husband doesn't even want to talk about it while I'm breaking up on the inside. They both had the same thoughts. One was running from it. The other was willing to find the greatest bridge between in life between the head and the heart. So even in theory, the whole idea is wrong. Secondly, some of the finest thinking in the world has been done by womankind. You see it. So this myth has to be dispensed with. It's purely an archaic thing. But to your question, is the Bible dishonorable like this in gender? We've just had Joe Vitale, who is on our team from Oxford. She has just defended her doctoral dissertation at Oxford on this very issue and this very subject, demonstrating how strongly the Bible speaks of the equality of the genders and what it is God has in mind and the complementariness of the two. So here is my question to you. If God were a discriminator against gender, the greatest truth on which the gospel hangs is the resurrection. If Christ be not raised from the dead, our faith is in vain. Why in heaven's name did he reveal himself to the women to go and tell the message? All of Easter hangs on the testimony of womankind with whom he trusted the entire gospel. When the woman with the alabaster ointment came to him and those were frowning about her, he looked at them and said, "Be quiet. Wherever the gospel is preached, there shall also this be told, what this woman has done to me in worship." He paid her the greatest compliment that the gospel would be carried to the ends of the earth, and this story of this woman's faith will also be told. He goes to Samaria, and he sees a woman of the well with five broken, shattered marriages. She was ethnically barred from the society, as it were, maritally broken and shattered five times. He made her the first evangelist to the Samaritan world. Imagine what an incredibly gracious God to remind us that none of us is superior to the other. We only have the same privilege of taking our distinctives and complementary strengths and carrying the message to the world. I can tell you this, I would never be here today if it weren't for the strength of my mother. And when my younger brother was 6 or 7 years old, he was dying with double pneumonia and typhoid. My dad had given up. Our family had given up. We were living in Delhi. And the doctor came and told us, my younger brother Ramesh, who's today the chairman of the Department of Pain Management at McMaster University in Canada. He was 6 or 7, dying. I remember seeing him as a bag of bones for the last time. I'm 6 years older than him. And I walked away from there, bidding him goodbye. He was unconscious. My mother refused to leave. She refused to leave. She sat by his bedside, and we were all worn to the bone, including my dad. And so 4 of us kids packed up, taken back home, and all of us lying in bed saying, "We've just lost our youngest." My mother sat by his bedside. Whatever she was doing, I don't know, and in sheer exhaustion, for days she hadn't slept, and just by his bedside crying out to God to rescue her son. Somewhere in the early hours of the morning, he began to move and began to, he was very much alive, but just quite worn out and broken. And that need of life was coming back to him. And the next day, when we all were told to come back to the hospital, his eyes were open and his whole life given fresh strength. There was only one out of the 6 of us there who had the strength to sit by that bedside and watch what loomed as a tragedy and watch the triumph to turn into victory. Anybody who thinks that's weak and lesser doesn't understand reality. God is the God of humankind. And the last thing Jesus said on the cross for the redemption of mankind was look at a young man and tell him not to forget his mother, to make sure she was also taken care of because a sword was piercing through her heart. That is our Lord, who treats all of us with intrinsic worth and reflective splendor. And I thank God for the beauty he has created in this complementariness.
Thank you.
Hi. I was wondering, I've grown up in steeped in church traditions. I've grown up, I went to a religious school. I still go to a religious school. And I feel that perhaps indirectly, I've been taught that the most important thing about Jesus is his death. And I was wondering how true that is.
Well, boy, without his death, there is no gospel. Without his resurrection, the death doesn't mean anything. I once gave a talk, great question, by the way. I once gave a talk at a business. I was talking about Easter at Diversity Day, because they'd never had a thing about Easter done at this particular business. And I made this statement, and I think it's true, that Christmas without Easter is meaningless. Easter without Christmas is not possible. So you see the birth and the death and the resurrection all wrapped up into the story. The story is the beginning, middle, and end. But when Jesus was asked, why have you come? He says, for this reason I have come. He's come to give his life as a ransom for many. That's the reason. Now that ransom is his death as a payment for sin, because what the gospel tells you and tells me is this. And by the way, if I can just have a short aside here. Jesus, I love Jesus for a lot of reasons. One of those reasons is he's not a salesperson who tells you what you want to hear. He tells you what you need to hear. It's a very terrible sales pitch to say, you're evil, come follow me. What kind of a poster is that? But people do it anyway. He tells you what you need to hear, not what you want to hear, in distinction to every other worldview, by the way, which tells you that you can do it yourself. You're the one who can make it on your own. And I think if the 24-hour news is one of the worst inventions of the past 20, 30 years. I got a clap over here on that one. But one thing it does provide us, though, is ample evidence that man is in need of a Savior who's not himself. We need someone who's not us to save us from ourselves because of our innate innate evil and our sin. Jesus told us that 2,000 years ago. So we need someone who can redeem us, who can pay the penalty that we deserve. Jesus says, I'm that guy. Now, what's interesting is, if he died and stayed dead, then how would you know he's right? He could be dead and, well, maybe he was right, maybe he was wrong, who knows? He's like everybody else, so maybe he was wrong. But he didn't stay dead. His death is the payment. When he says, on that cross, tetelestai, when he says that in the Greek, it actually means it is finished, it is accomplished. It's a financial term, paid in full. It's like a stamp on a document. The debt is paid. That is done for us. But you can know that he was right, that he took away the sins of the world through that death because of his resurrection. If he died and stayed dead, no way to know. But he didn't die and stay dead. He showed his conquering over that death, his conquering over the last enemy through the physical and, I believe, truly historical resurrection from the dead. So the death without the resurrection doesn't really show you anything, but the resurrection shows that the death meant something. In fact, let me just put it this way plainly, it meant everything. Thank you.
Some years ago, I had the privilege of speaking at the United Nations, and they had asked me to speak on a search for absolutes in a relativistic world. It's a tough subject, especially in the early hours of the morning. And you're given about 18 minutes. And what I did in my talk is talked about four absolutes that we really look for: evil, justice, love, and forgiveness. I said we all have the desire to call some nation an evil nation. You brand some nations evil nations. But you all also talk about justice. You want just societies. You all love your families and you miss your families. And then some of you are going to blow it ethically, and you need to be forgiven. Evil, justice, love, and forgiveness. So I said to them, where in the world did all of these converge at one point in history? There was pin drop silence. I said they converged on a hill called Calvary. And as that meeting was over and I presented to them the message of Calvary, they were lined up, the ambassadors. And one of them came to me, shook my hand, and he said, Dr. Zacharias, he said, I come from an atheistic nation. And I don't want to be here. My president asked me to come here. I hate being here. I miss being here. But I want to say to you, today I have found out why I came here. I came here to find God. I came here to find God. Recently, I was in a Middle Eastern nation where the Minister of Finance came and asked if he could talk to me personally. Some of my colleagues know which one I'm talking about. He doesn't want to be there. So much violence. He sent his family out. And he said, I'm only here because of my faith and the sacrifice that Christ made for me, that I want to do my part in life. To take one aspect of the gospel and make it the most important aspect is actually that which God had joined together. Let no one put asunder. It is the birth, life, death, and resurrection. They are all put together. His death was spoken of, prophesied, and so was his resurrection. Even Paul struggled with that I may know him, the power of his resurrection, and the fellowship of his suffering, being made conformable unto his death. One thing the death of Christ does is answer for me the question of evil and pain and suffering that no other worldview offers. My colleague Vince Vitale and I wrote the book, Why Suffering? And in that I made the comment that God does not conquer in spite of the dark mystery of evil. He conquers through it. He conquers through it. So the cross is central, but it is not in isolation. Because you and I do not need a guru. We need a savior to offer and heal that which is central to your life and mine. And the Cross of Christ by John Stott is one of the most powerful books I have ever read. If you haven't read that book by John R. W. Stott, it's an all-time classic. Please take it and read it. But it fits into the grand design of God's total plan. Thank you for asking that. And now I come to this closing. And so whether you're speaking at the Center for Geopolitical Strategy in Moscow or the UN or a university or sitting next to somebody in a plane, the only answer I have seen is in the person of Jesus Christ on the four questions of life, of origin, meaning, morality, and destiny. And especially to you students, may I say this, you have a rare privilege. You have a very rare privilege. I didn't have the mind that you all do, frankly, and I'm not putting this up, but I would never have made it into a university like this. I lived for cricket. I wanted to play cricket. I was a sports person. I wanted to play cricket for India. That was my goal. I neglected my studies, never worked hard, ended up with shame on a bed of suicide. In about 2 weeks from now, I'm speaking at St. Stephen's College at the University of Delhi, probably the premier institution in the whole country of that specific nature. Anybody here from India will tell you St. Stephen's College, Delhi, most of India's students would never even get in. And yet the principal has asked me if I would come there and present a defense of the Christian faith. God has a sense of humor. I would never have made it as a student. And now they're asking me to come and speak to them. This is how God does it. Because the coherence of the Judeo-Christian worldview deals with where you are. And you have two options to go with. And I'll close with this and give you what I think would be a marvelous response on your part. Your tensions are great. Your allurements are great. Your physicality is a strength but also makes you vulnerable. You are possibly oftentimes at the mercy of an academic who wants to knock God out of you. This happens again and again and again. I hear it so often. I will tell you this. You reject God and your worldview will become systemically incoherent. You follow the truth where it leads, and in the person of Christ you will find personal meaning and the meaning that God can help you carry it to the rest of the world. Konrad Adenauer, after the Second World War, was alone with Billy Graham. Billy Graham is not very formally educated, and he will tell you that with a minimal education, God's anointed him. Konrad Adenauer looked at Billy Graham. Billy Graham told this to us around a gathering of lunch. And he looked at me and he said, Mr. Graham, do you believe Jesus Christ really rose from the dead? And Graham said, Mr. Adenauer, if I didn't believe that, I would have no message left to preach to the world. He said, Konrad Adenauer walked out towards the window, looked out of that window and turned around. He said, looking at the ruins of his city, he said, Mr. Graham, outside of the resurrection of Jesus Christ, I know of no other hope for mankind. Outside of the resurrection of Jesus Christ, I know of no other hope for mankind. Several years ago, when I was a young man just starting my ministry living in Toronto, I was driving on the 401. It was a cold night, snowy night. I was driving in my little Volkswagen Red Bug, and I saw a guy on the side of the road thumbing for a ride on a highway. I said, somebody's going to run over him. I pulled up on the side quite late at night, about 10:30. I opened the door. I said, are you okay? He said, can you take me home, sir? I said, where do you live? And he told me it was not near my home, but I was fearful for him. and fearful for myself. He's a total stranger. I said, come on in. So before he even said anything, I said, please give me your name. He said, my name is Lorne Lusthouse. I said, as we are driving, talk to me about who you are, and then I will tell you what I do. And as we were driving, he said to me, tonight's been another night. Same thing, liquor, fun, everything. He said, Ravi, I'm a messed up young guy. I'm totally messed up. He was stopping, pausing, thinking, collecting his thoughts. And I dropped him off at his home. I took his hand. I said, Lorne, I'm leaving out of town early tomorrow morning. Will you please see me when I come back next week? Here is my phone number and my address. I want to see you. I want to meet with you. He said, okay. And he took my phone number and address. When I came back, there was a letter waiting for me from Lorne Lusthouse. But when I contacted, I found out that week he had burned himself to death as well. And in my letter was this poem. I want you to think about it. Lost in a world of darkness, without a guiding light, seeking a friend to help my struggling, failing plight. So all of you good people just go on passing by, leaving me with nothing but this lonely will to die. For somewhere in this lonely world of sorrow and of woe, there's a place for me to hide, but where, I do not know. For no matter where I go, I never will escape the devil's reaching, clutching hand or the drink of fermented grape. So out of my grief and anguish, perhaps some wandering boy will see and build his own life in this world, strong and good and free.
You've been watching Let My People Think with Dr. Ravi Zacharias. We're grateful for your prayers and financial support. If you'd like to know more about this ministry or would like to donate to our efforts, you can call us at 1-800-448-6766 or visit us online at www.rzim.org. You can also stay connected to RZIM through Twitter and Facebook. Our mailing address is RZIM, Post Office Box 921-939, Norcross, Georgia, 30013.